This is River to River. I'm Dean Borg, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. Major decisions today from the U.S. Supreme Court. Political scientist Donna Hoffman from the University of Northern Iowa and the University of Iowa's Tim Hagel will be commenting on the political implications of the Supreme Court rulings on same-sex marriage and the voting rights law. And we'll also be talking about the Farm Bill's future and Iowa politics as candidates line up to get their names on the ballot. And we're inviting your comments. Politics Day with political scientist Tim Hagel and Donna Hoffman. River to River, right after the NPR News. Dean Borg with River to River, and what a news day it is in Washington and across the nation with Supreme Court decisions yesterday and today, and we're going to be talking about that on River to River. Our guests in the studios, Donna Hoffman, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa, Tim Hagel, professor of political science at the University of Iowa, and we're going to have other guests weighing in as we go along on the show. But just to get right to it, the U.S. Supreme Court this morning issuing a ruling overturning the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA as it's called. That ruling clears the way for federal recognition of same-sex marriages that have been legally granted in some states, such as Iowa. Kate Varnum and her partner were the lead plaintiffs in the Iowa Supreme Court ruling that cleared the way for same-sex marriage in this state, Iowa. And speaking with Iowa Public Radio this morning, Varnum says the rest of the nation can now look to Iowa's experience with marriage equality.
We're getting close to 5 years. We will hit 5 years in April of legal marriage in Iowa. And people are realizing that it doesn't affect their own marriages to see that their neighbors are able to enjoy the same protections that they have. We have not destroyed any marriages. I know a few people who have gotten divorced since our marriage became legal, but we weren't the cause of that. You know, there are other factors in that, but people are realizing that the world didn't end. And there is nothing wrong with seeing families recognized legally.
And that's Kate Varnum. She and her partner, as I say, the lead plaintiffs in the Iowa Supreme Court case, that ruling then clearing the way for same-sex marriage in Iowa. Welcoming our guests now, Tim Hagel at the University of Iowa. Hello,
hey
Tim.
Hey there.
And Donna Hoffman. Hello, Donna.
Hello, Dean. Hello, Tim.
You heard what Kate Varnum just said. Weigh in on that, if you will, Tim. Are other states going to be looking now at Iowa as a model as to implementing same-sex marriage?
I'm not sure so much in terms of implementing it. I think that what Varnum said was similar to things that I had said even when the decision was made, that in a year or two afterwards, where the way I phrased it was that the sky hasn't fallen, that certainly there was a lot of intensity immediately following the decision, particularly in terms of the elections, judicial retentions that we had here in 2010, where the three Supreme Court justices were removed, not retained. But, you know, as Varnum said, it really hasn't affected people directly. There are certainly indirect effects in various ways, but for the most part, it hasn't really bothered folks. And so the intensity has subsided. Whether other states decide to follow Iowa's example or not, whether they do it through a judicial decision or through state legislature, is really up to the individual state.
And Donna, I'd like your opinion on what Kate Varnum said, and also about the future implications for us here in Iowa of the ruling today in the Iowa Supreme or in the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, certainly, you know, I think Tim's correct in terms of what the states do is really up to the states at this point. In terms of Iowa being a model, of course, here the court action is what allowed for same-sex marriage. In other states, and we saw this in 2012, there have been ballot initiatives, there have been state legislative actions, and other court decisions in those states. So there's a lot of paths that states can take. What the decision today in the Windsor case does for the state of Iowa and other states where same-sex marriage is already legal is that it extends those federal benefits to same-sex couples. In the other states, though, that it was not a question that the court considered in terms of how states have defined marriage. And there are 30-plus states that do have state laws or constitutional planks that talk about marriage as only between a man and a woman. And that was not a question in the constitutionality of those state constitutional issues was not a question before the court. And both Roberts in his dissent and Kennedy in his opinion made clear that this is applying to states that have the legalized same-sex marriage relationships. But what happens in those states then that do have these laws that have definitions, you know, we may see state legislative action mounted. We may see ballot initiatives mounted in various paths to get to the point where it would be legal. And then you will have some states that won't move very quickly on those probably as well. And there may be further federal actions in that regard.
Right. And in terms of sort of the long-term view of this, as it was very interesting that today's decision emphasized states' rights fairly heavily, giving the impression at least that states can do what they want in terms of marriage benefits. But on the other hand, you could also make that equal protection argument that once you've said that the federal government can't deny benefits across the board, that whenever a state says that, you know, we recognize same-sex marriage, and therefore the federal government has to provide similar benefits, then it becomes a question, well, can one state say, yes, we're going to recognize same-sex marriage and provide benefits, and the state next door says no? And there are some areas of the law where the court does allow that kind of difference from state to state, but other areas where they don't. And so that's one of the big questions that remains.
So politically, how is this going to play out in the various states? Will it have any political effect here in Iowa? Donna?
Well, I think, you know, you could see, and I haven't, you know, this is a pretty fresh decision,
yes,
obviously. I haven't seen any comments from people in the state, in particular people with a family leader who may take a position on this case as they have in other cases.
Bob Vonderplatz.
Right. And so I haven't seen what they have said on this. But, you know, this certainly is something that for that, you know, what is now probably a relatively small minority of people who fiercely oppose same-sex marriage in the state, this could be, you know, an issue that further tries to galvanize them. But, you know, we had another justice from the Varnum decision up in 2012 that was actually retained. So that issue has kind of faded. And public opinion has moved really quickly on this issue as, again, as Tim mentioned earlier, people have seen the sky hasn't fallen. And people's experience with same-sex marriage has really changed public opinion in a lot of ways pretty quickly. And that has happened in Iowa and it's happened in some other places as well.
And Tim, building on what Donna has just said, the effect of this court's decision today and Iowa's experience already and then public opinion shifting rather rapidly on this subject, what does that have in store then, implications for the family leader, Bob Vonderplatz and Danny Carroll, and on political alignments and future candidacies?
Well, it's kind of an open question that I know that some folks would just as soon, and thinking on the Republican side of things, that they really don't want to deal with this issue, particularly they don't see that it has a high priority, especially right now, that it often they're more concerned with fiscal issues. And this was the case in 2010, more or less, except again here in Iowa, we did have the judicial retentions that were a big issue. But in the 2012 elections, that a lot of Republicans wanted to focus on the fiscal rather than the social issues. But on the other hand, when you have a decision like this that has a sort of a national scope, again, it applied to particular states, but it has that national implication that it does tend to get some folks fired up. So you probably will see some people who want to defend traditional marriage to make this an issue. The question will be as to whether any candidates want to really take that on at a time when they think that they really ought to be focusing on other issues, particularly fiscal issues, but even things like immigration and gun control, and, mm-hmm. and President Obama gave his climate change speech yesterday. So these issues tend to be ones that are higher on people's radar screen. Well, I guess that's a bad metaphor, but basically more important to them than same-sex marriage.
And I'd like to ask our listeners now to, I mean, you used the word fired up. We'll see how fired up people are about this. We invite you to join us now on the air with your comments, 866-780-9100, or post them on our Facebook page or tweet us at IPR Talk. That's IPR Talk for tweeting, Facebook page, or 866-780-9100. We'd like to hear what you have to say about what happened today at the U.S. Supreme Court. Do you see that present candidates are going to have to shift positions at all? They've been, and people are fairly outspoken on this, and the political alignments are fairly concrete. What happened today, is it going to modify some of that? We're going to hear some rhetoric changes, Tim?
Well, probably not so much, although apparently Senator Grassley, and I don't know if he originally tweeted this or was part of a statement, but I did see it on Twitter, where he basically said, look, it doesn't matter what I think. This, it's the law of the land because the Supreme Court has made its decision, so there you go. On the other hand, apparently there's some representative in the U.S. House that has, I don't know if he's done, probably hasn't done it yet, but he has indicated a desire to submit a constitutional amendment. Probably won't go anywhere, but there's certainly going to be people that will use it in their campaigns if they think it's going to be a big issue in their district. And so that's the thing, is that will it be an issue that plays in a particular district or a particular state? And it may very well. And even for presidential candidates, that they may want to weigh in on it. But like I said, I think for a lot of folks that thinking on the Republican side, they're probably going to focus on the fiscal issues. On the Democratic side, they may be more likely to say, hey, this is good. Maybe if it's a state that hasn't recognized gay marriage, or if it's a state that maybe has, through legislative process of one sort or another, put a ban on it, that they may use this as a way to spur a way to reverse that ban.
Donna, you mentioned shifting public opinion toward more acceptance of same-sex marriage. Will that shifting public opinion, because these are voters, they're the ones who mark the X or pull the lever in the voting booth, will the shifting public opinion, coupled with today's Supreme Court decision, will that make big changes, do you think, that are going to be noticeable very quickly?
Well, I think, if we look at Congress, we've already seen some there's room, I should say, in the GOP now for acceptance of same-sex marriage. We have, over the last several months, seen some prominent members of Congress from the GOP come out and accept same-sex marriage. Most recently, Lisa Murkowski, senator from Alaska, has done that. And, the cynical people say, well, these people were trying to get out ahead of this issue in light of kind of the oral arguments on this particular case. But nevertheless, it is becoming less of a defining issue. There's room within the party for some diversity on this issue, at least in some quarters. And so I think public opinion has already really affected that in a lot of ways. And it's not an issue where Democrats stand here and Republicans stand here. There's within the Republican Party, there's some movement even on that. And to a large degree, I think you can attribute that to shifts in public opinion.
Tim and Donna, we asked for others to join our conversation here, and we have a call coming in. I think it's Greg in Cedar Falls. Whoops, just dropped off my screen. And I'm sorry, I started to put him on the air here, and he just dropped off my screen. So we'll hope that he'll call back. But maybe we've already made his point. Let's go on to another decision that came out this week, and that was the voting rights. And that really was a state's rights decision too, wasn't it, Tim?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, that's sort of what I saw is that, and sent this out on Twitter, I said that even though ideologically the Voting Rights Act decision before and today's DOMA Act, they're on opposite sides of the fence in terms of the politics, but they both recognize states' rights in terms of their interests and what they want to do. And so it's sort of a different dimension to the two cases.
Mm-hmm. Donna?
Yeah, I think, the voting rights case is interesting in a lot of ways, and especially when compared to the DOMA case and some of the dynamics there. But, in particular, this this voting rights case. I mean, I think after the oral arguments, there was a lot of consternation in some quarters, glee in other quarters, that the court would in fact strike down Section 5, and that's not what they did. They struck down Section 4 of that, which effectively renders Section 5 inoperable. But they put the ball in Congress's court and said to them, you know, it's up to you now to change this formula at which you get a state into preclearance. And you know, there were there was a lot of commentary about the overwhelming nature by which Congress reauthorized this act in 2006, and you know, the court really, again, took one part of this this act and said, this is the problem. You can't use this old data. You have to redo this formula. And then you could still have states in preclearance. So, you know, it is a for civil rights groups in particular, it's a decision that they really do not welcome. But it could have been worse in a lot of ways, and that's cold comfort, I'm sure, to a lot of people who look at this case. But you know, it's a nuanced case in some respects that now the ball is in Congress's court. It's highly unlikely in this Congress that they will take that up, I think, and it's probably unlikely in future Congresses. But that remains to be seen. The dynamics of this are still, you know, being fleshed out.
That's right. It's less than 24 hours old, that decision. But the reaction from the civil rights community was immediate and loud and harsh. And Tim, was it given the fact that congressional action can change this? It was a law that the Supreme Court said needed to be updated as to its parameters and enforcement. And some of the states that it was applying to were saying, you're treating us like kids, and we've grown out of what was the case when this law was first enacted. Given that, would you say that the civil rights community is overreacting and perhaps reacting to any erosion in what's been won over the years as being a setback for them?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, even as you were framing your question, I was thinking of the word overreacting there. Other people have put it different ways. But yeah, I think that there's a certain concern, legitimate, that you get into, the idea of a slippery slope kind of a thing. But that's not really what the Supreme Court said. And I was trying to think of some analogy for this. And what I came up with was the idea is, well, you know, if you're sick, you go to the doctor, doctor prescribes some medicine for you. When you get well, you stop taking the medicine. Now, on the other hand, having made that analogy, there are some illnesses that you never stop taking the medicine. So I suppose that may be part of what fuels this, is that, is this a situation where the malady has been cured, or is there, as some believe, an inherent racism in the country that must always be protected? But even aside from that, the idea is, as the Supreme Court said, that the reason that these states were put into this preclearance category is no longer present. And that's why the Congress has to come up with a better formula, that the court recognizes that discrimination still may exist, but we need to find where it is, and it's not where it had been.
Donna, does it have more effect on the certain targeted states than it does on Iowa?
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that the Voting Rights Act also affects is redistricting, and the way districts are carved in most states, but not in Iowa, is very partisan, and that can have racial implications. And in Iowa, the way we carve out districts is nonpartisan, and we have to keep counties whole, and it's really a very unique system, and so this has less impact just for that reason than it will have on some other states.
And also, does it have more effect on candidates for federal office than state and local elections, in your opinion, Donna?
Not necessarily, because some of the things that were at issue, and you know, when Congress reauthorized this, they you know, brought in volumes of testimony and things to you know, flesh out whether this needed to be reauthorized or not, and there. You may in fact see more things happening at the local level, because oftentimes those kinds of actions, like changing to at-large elections or something like that, may be kind of flying under the radar. And so I would not characterize it in that particular way, that you do see some effects potentially at local levels and state levels in those preclearance states that now don't have to pass preclearance, that you may have some interesting effects there. But it remains to be seen.
I want to get to a couple of more topics here before we break for the news at the bottom of the hour. And one is the other decision on racial preference for college admissions. It involved the University of Texas, Tim, and maybe you can background us a little bit there. But they were, and other schools, I think there was a similar ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court involving the University of Michigan a few years ago. But this one involved the University of Texas. The initial suit was brought there. And what are the implications of what happened?
Well, basically, when you have what are termed elite schools that have, in some sense, a cap on their admissions, that they have to, at some point, make choices in terms of who's in and who's out.
In order to get racial equality?
And that's the thing, is that all schools are going to do that, even with schools that don't necessarily have a cap, that they have criteria as far as who's going to be in and who's going to be out. But when you have a cap set on it, then you're going to make these choices. And because most schools desire a certain mix of their undergraduates and on a variety of characteristics, race being one of them, it means that schools sometimes make choices where, as in the case with the University of Texas, a white student was denied admission over perhaps other students that had other criteria in their favor, including race. And so when that happens, of course, when race is used as a factor, it gets what the Supreme Court calls strict scrutiny. And even though one element of that is what's called a compelling interest, and the Supreme Court said back in the Bakke decision of the late 70s that having a diverse student body is a compelling governmental interest for a public university, it still requires, and this is what the Supreme Court said in its recent case in Fisher, that the use of race has to be necessary for the school to achieve that diverse student interest. And in the University of Michigan cases, the court gave a fair amount of deference to the university, and right. Courts were giving too much deference, and that's what the court said in Fisher.
Donna, in this ruling on college admission and favoritism being given to some demographic groups, as Tim has outlined here, any political implications in that, or is it pretty much confined to the civil rights and academic communities?
Well, I think any political implications actually kind of remain to be seen. And furthermore, this case really, you know, in some ways, you know, well, not in some ways, it did, in fact, send this decision back to the Fifth Circuit.
Yes.
And it's still kind of an evolving area in terms of where the court stands on this. Now they want this court to apply strict scrutiny to this particular case. There's probably future litigation that comes, maybe even out of this case again, in terms of the strict scrutiny standard that the Fifth Circuit's supposed to apply. There's another case that the court has accepted relatively recently, I think this spring, on the University of Michigan. And so there's other affirmative action things that are boiling up. And so this is really still an evolving area. And in terms of political implications, and that kind of is also evolving, it remains to be seen what happens there. But by and large, this is not something the public pays a whole lot of attention
yes.
to. It really is in some ways kind of confined to the academic community, and especially on a decision like this where it's kind of murky in terms of what it said. The court did, you know, on this case, it's interesting, both sides of this case have claimed victory. And, you know, what the court did not do was strike down racial preferences that are used in university admissions. So that side claims victory. The other side claims victory because it was sent back and strict scrutiny needs to be applied. And so it's still kind of pretty murky. And the public doesn't pay a lot of attention to those kinds of cases, I think, until it becomes more clear what the implications of it are.
Let me just in our final seconds here before we go to news, we have some reaction on the Supreme Court's decision on the Defense of Marriage Act, and Tracy writes on Facebook to us, perhaps now California, he says, can become as progressive as and inclusive as Iowa. And Eric writes, Iowa is not a progressive state on gay marriage or generally. People here are generally passive. He says, if the Iowa Supreme Court had not made gay marriage legal, it would still not be legal. There was no political interest, and the public certainly did not advocate for it. That comment from Eric on our Facebook account. We're going to continue this discussion in the coming half hour, but right now, breaking for a bit of breaking news here in Iowa. This is River to River on Iowa Public Radio. Dean Borg continuing River to River, and we have guest Donna Hoffman, who is a professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa, and Tim Hagel, political science at the University of Iowa. But we're being joined right now from Washington, D.C., by Iowa Congressman Steve King, who has just seconds ago called in, as we had requested him to do. And Congressman King, welcome to River to River.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me on. I'm in an elevator about ready to get out, so I should be able to pay attention here in a minute or so. But we can give it a try.
Okay. Let me just say, Congressman King, is it that we might lose a signal from you in the middle here, or where are you headed once you get out of that elevator?
I need to just put up a quick vote, and then I can pay complete attention to the dean. So this is real-time transmission, I understand.
Yes.
And the timing of what we're doing here is, but in about 30 seconds, I will be completely focused. So
all right.
If you have an introduction or something,
yes,
or an introductory statement, I can listen to that.
You come back. When you are able to talk with us, you let me know. Just break right in and to our conversation, and I'll know that you're ready to talk. Go ahead with your
Dean,
business.
I'm ready right now. I put up the vote. So
all right.
Now I can pay attention. Sorry, I didn't get that time just a little bit better.
Well, the news breaking in Washington today, and I know that you're working on the farm bill, and that's why I asked you to call in, because I want to talk to you about the farm bill. But major decisions this morning from the U.S. Supreme Court. And are you expecting that Iowans will notice anything different in their daily lives, workplace environment, schools, churches, because of the court's ruling today invalidating the Defense of Marriage Act?
Well, at this point, I think not. From what I understand, and I have not gotten my hands on the decision, and some of this is just verbally passed around through the grapevine circle here, but as I understand this, the court did not invalidate the state's ability to define marriage between a man and a woman, which about 38 states have some policy such as that, but they do essentially require the federal government to pay out same-sex benefits into those states if the couples that reside within those states, or any state for that matter, were legally married in another state. So it requires the federal government to honor a same-sex marriage, but not necessarily state benefits, if that's how I understand it, and there's a lot more to be digested in this before I can go much further. So I don't know that Iowa changes very much. And, you know, Iowa has its policy that is court-ordered judicial fiat, and I've disagreed with the court's ability to do that. It should be by the voice of the people if it's going to happen at all, and there are precedents for that, and I've disagreed with the legislature when they pass legislation, but when it's done in a constitutional fashion, I support the decision, and that's so I want to read down through this, and I want to read the majority opinion in the court, and I want to read the dissenting opinion. I want to see what constitutional underpinnings they identified in that decision. I don't yet know what they are.
Yeah.
I'm grateful they didn't go to the Equal Protection Clause and just wipe out all of traditional marriage in the country. I'm grateful that at least we're able to preserve it within the states at this point.
Congressman King, I have Donna Hoffman from the University of Northern Iowa and Tim Hagel with me in the studio, and I'm going to ask, I think Tim Hagel has a question for you, and Donna may have a follow-up too. Tim?
Sure.
Well, not so much a question, but just to follow up on what Representative King was saying is that it's probably not going to see a major effect here in Iowa. Where you will see more of an effect are states that still don't recognize some form of same-sex marriage, but have people in their states who were married in states that did recognize it and are now living in their state. So you're still going to see some difference among the citizens of a particular state as to whether they're going to get those federal benefits.
Donna?
No, I don't have anything.
Okay. Congressman King, any reaction to what Tim Hagel just said?
Well, I generally agree. And I was thinking about those states that have military bases in them with a high population of military personnel. That'd be the places, say, if a state has a ban on same-sex marriage, or if they define marriage as being specifically between a man and a woman, if they have a state DOMA Act, then they're not going to be marrying people out in the civil ceremonies or religious ceremonies outside and off the base, but there likely will be, I'll say, significant numbers on the base who are bound in by this through the federal the federal command of this court, so to speak. So I think those are the places where we see the most of it.
Let me ask this, Congressman King. Will this in any way, or the voting rights decision yesterday, change in any way the way that you campaign and represent the 4th Congressional District of Iowa?
Well, that's a good question. I haven't encountered that thought at all since then. You know, I do stand up for what I believe in, but I think it's important for all of us to read, learn, understand, and interpret the Constitution and defend its principles. I think I do that, and I do it in a serious way. So I seriously want to go back and see what the Supreme Court has seen. I'm very confident that the drafters, the framers, and the ratifiers of our Constitution and all 27 amendments in it understood something differently than this court seems to understand today. But I want to know why they said that. And then, as I said, I'll accept a decision by the state legislature if they decide they're going to approve same-sex marriage in Iowa. But I don't accept the court's decision. I've read it. It's 63 pages. I disagree with that. I don't think it's even rational, let alone disagree with their rationale. But when we get to the Voting Rights Act, I was just sat down in a meeting with our Judiciary Committee members on my Republican side of this and made the point that we should not race forward with this and try to do something out of fear that, you know, we'll be, let's say, be called names by folks on the other side. But we should prudently look at the Section 4 and Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act and see that we can preserve and make sure that people are getting to the polls and that they have their right to vote, and we should preserve and protect that always.
Carson King.
I can just make one more point quickly. That is that the people that are under the covered districts in that, the minorities are voting in greater percentages than the non-minorities in those areas. So I think we've made a lot of progress.
I know that your time is limited, and so I want to get right to the Farm Bill, the reason for us calling you today. The House defeated its version of the Farm Bill late last week, but you're working on a Farm Bill today in what is called markup. Now, is that legislation already passed by the Senate that you're working on now?
No, actually, what we're doing today is I've set up a meeting with Chairman Frank Lucas of Oklahoma. We'll be meeting sometime in a little better than an hour and talking about our strategy about how to put this all back together again to see if we can. And it's really a matter of there were 62 Republicans that voted no. There were 24 Democrats that voted yes. We need to look down through it and go out and canvass all 62 of the Republicans that voted no and see what can we do to get them to come around to yes. And we need to look at the 24 Democrats and think how many of those might we lose or how many more can we gain when what policy is. It's like moving the center of balancing a teeter-totter, so to speak, and trying to get that fulcrum in just the right place where we can get 108 or 218 votes. And at this point, I don't know if we can do it, but we are surely going to try. We spoke about it this morning in conference, and we had a long discussion about how important this is. And so if we can get our strategy put in place today and tomorrow, we've got over the 4th of July break in order to work this thing. And hopefully when we come back, we'll be on the path towards finding those 218 votes.
So what you're trying to do is resurrect some sort of semblance of what the House has already defeated rather than taking up the Senate bill, because Iowa congressmen, they're Democrats, Bruce Braley and Dave Lobosak, along with Illinois Congresswoman Sherry Boutrous, introduced the Senate version of the Farm Bill in the House today. Now, why aren't you on that list? Isn't that the path to go to get something going and get it onto conference committee?
Well, no, I don't support the Senate bill. And, you know, this technique is not one that I don't think is constructive towards getting the votes here in the House. The Senate bill is not going to pass in the House. The votes aren't here to do that. And so we've got to find the right policy to get to 218. And I don't think, in fact, I didn't know they did that, but I'm sorry that that happened, because this tactic is no more constructive than the discharge petition was last year. It is a political maneuver more so than a constructive one. These negotiations need to be taking place member to member, face to face, and that's how I'm doing it now, and that's how I intend to work this thing and to try to get to 218 votes. If we take up the Senate bill, it would fail here on the House, worse than the version that we brought to the floor. So I'm sorry that's out there, but it is, and every member has the have a privilege and a right to do as they choose.
I know that your time is precious, and we're running out of time here, too, but where would you predict that there might be some compromises? You said the Republicans met this morning. Who's going to lose some provisions, either in food assistance or assistance for farmers? Where is there going to be compromise?
Well, I think that there are Republican votes to be picked up by by tightening down the categorical components of the nutrition side of this. There are. I've talked to a good number of members that said we didn't do enough. They've been so pushing and expanding the food stamp side of this that we've got to bring it. We've got to reform it. Well, I agree, but we need to take what we can get. And so I thought we should have settled in on the number that we had arrived at that $20.5 billion. But if we go further that way, how many Democrats do we lose? On the other hand, if we take the nutrition component of this and we take the $20.5 billion in reductions that are there and say dial it down to 10, we're going to lose more Republicans, I believe, than we can gain as Democrats.
Okay.
And so it is an impasse right now, and it's going to have to be finely tuned in.
Congressman King, thanks so much for joining us today on River to River, and we'll let you get back to work there. And thank you so much for taking time to be with us.
Well, I'm glad to be there. I'm sorry we had to do that real time as I stepped on the floor to vote. But thanks for being your patience, and I look forward to the next time we get to talk to you.
Thank you. And I'm going to ask Donna Hoffman, who herself has to leave in just a couple of minutes. But Donna, you heard Congressman King and what he said. On the farm bill, what are the politics of this struggle as you see it? You heard him say where there might be some adjustments in the Republican-dominated House of Representatives in order to get that passed through the House and get it onto conference committee. What'd you take from what he said?
Well, notice that he really only talked about the food stamps or the SNAP side of the equation there and the amount of cuts. So in the Senate bill, there were about $4 billion worth of cuts that they had there. The House bill, as he mentioned, it was about $20 billion. And they lost some Democrats. They lost some Republicans. And, he's right in talking, I think, about that issue. I think that is the major issue, holding it up and then putting that coalition together to either pick up some Republicans but not shave off some Democrats, and it's probably a pretty fine-tuned negotiation that they have to do in that regard to get that, into conference with the Senate.
Donna, thanks so much for joining us today, and we're going to give you an early exit, too, because I know you have another appointment. So thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Dean.
Tim, what are the politics of this struggle? Is it urban versus farm interests, rural interests, because the coalition that has passed farm bills in the past, 80% of that, what's called the farm bill, goes to food assistance, what we say food stamps, or now it's called the SNAP program, and 20% is farm price supports, which is now going to be converted from direct support to crop insurance. So what are the politics of this whole thing?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the urban-rural split, and it's not so much urban-rural per se, it's where the numbers are and that there are just more people that live in urban areas than there are in rural areas, because certainly there are people in rural areas that benefit from the food stamp program, SNAP, as it were, but more of them in urban areas. Mm-hmm. And so that's why it becomes a much more political issue. But when you talk about the farm bill, that often is a way to then get a lot of those rural areas, in particular members of Congress in the rural and farm states, on board so that they are supporting the farm portion of that, the 20%, and maybe are willing to go along with the rest of it as well. But given the fiscal tightening that we see in Congress in a variety of ways, and some people have emphasized that the S in SNAP stands for supplemental, so it's not supposed to be the entire budget. It's supposed to help for people that need it. So that becomes an issue as well, and it becomes more complicated. And as Representative King was indicating, that you're trying to find a certain balance in the House to try to get, and as Donna emphasize too, enough Republicans to join it so that it passes without losing the Democrats who had voted for it first. Of course, then it goes to conference, and who knows what's going to come out there and whether that would pass the House or the Senate.
And that's key. I mean, what's worked out in conference, a small group of people representing the House and the Senate trying to come to a compromise, but then that has to go back to the floor of both houses,
right,
there and may not pass.
Right, and the difference between $4 billion versus $20 billion is pretty big. And even if you split that difference and say something in between like $12 billion, well, is that going to be too much for the Senate Democrats? It'll be not enough of a cut for the House Republicans. And, usually they have some sort of deal worked out where if the conference approves it, then the House, both chambers will, but possibly not.
You who are listening have been with us on all these topics, and we invite you to join the conversation. You can call in at 866-780-9100, or you can post comments on our Facebook page, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Again, the phone number is 866-780-9100. Tim, President Obama this week used Georgetown University before he took off on an international trip as the backdrop for announcing new measures to combat climate change. We're coming on this subject right after the Farm Bill. And you recall that in his State of the Union address, the president called on Congress to develop a bipartisan plan to accomplish the task of reducing carbon emissions. But in a polarized Congress, that hasn't happened. And in his speech yesterday, the president, as you know, outlined an alternative that's within his power in the executive branch, and he outlined executive orders to meet that goal.
Now, today, about 40% of America's carbon pollution comes from our power plants. But here's the thing. Right now, there are no federal limits to the amount of carbon pollution that those plants can pump into our air. None. Zero. We limit the amount of toxic chemicals like mercury and sulfur and arsenic in our air or our water, but power plants can still dump unlimited amounts of carbon pollution into the air for free. That's not right, that's not safe, and it needs to stop. So, today, for the sake of our children and the health and safety of all Americans, I'm directing the Environmental Protection Agency to put an end to the limitless dumping of carbon pollution from our power plants and complete new pollution standards for both new and existing power plants.
Well, Tim Hagel, that was not good news for the coal industry. Coal stocks took a beating on the news that President Obama is calling for the end of government subsidies for U.S. companies that build coal plants overseas without using carbon capture, as it's called, technology. Well, with immigration reform, gun control, I'm going down a litany here, and deficit reduction, big issues, the Farm Bill, why climate change? Why climate change now?
Well, two reasons spring to mind. The more cynical view is that it's a way to change the subject. That right now, the administration is embroiled in a variety of scandals. They don't all touch Obama necessarily, but part of his administration, and the idea of the buck stops here. And he would like to, you know, change the topic onto something that he's more comfortable with. The second reason is simply because, as you indicated, that they haven't really made much progress on gun control. The immigration is going back and forth, and he certainly would like to make some progress on his agenda, maybe looking towards that notion of a presidential legacy. He, of course, has Obamacare, and that sort of has mixed reaction at this point, the Affordable Care Act. But if he could do something on climate change, then that's something that he can tout as a success for his administration.
That's so right. Legacy.
A legacy, right.
Something in there, too. Nothing miffs Congress, and that's a soft word. Nothing miffs Congress more than bypassing Congress.
Right.
And he's doing that with executive orders. So what are the politics of that? Is he well enough into his second administration and said, I'm going to do this in order to build legacy and the other reasons, as you said?
Well, I'm not sure that it's a matter of where he is in his second term, but that's something that he has done fairly consistently. And in fact, in the news this last week is that the Supreme Court took a case involving the National Labor Relations Board and recess appointments where effectively he bypassed Congress. Congress wasn't approving his nominees to the board, and so he made what he considered recess appointments in the Senate, saying, well, no, we weren't in recess, and so now that case is going before the Supreme Court. So, yes, there is that tension between Congress. Even some Democrats in Congress may not appreciate the idea that the president is doing these things on his own without their input. So we kind of have to wait and see as to how the politics play out, but it's certainly not going to make Congress happy, we'll phrase it that way, that he does this.
Well, let's hear from Jeffrey in Des Moines. He thinks that there's an altruistic motive here. Go ahead, Jeffrey.
Yeah, I was just going to say, leading scientists around the world are saying the future of Homo sapiens is at stake and all species based on climate. So perhaps the president is just being logical in trying to address perhaps the biggest problem the 7 billion people on the planet face.
And we hear you loud and clear, and I'm going to ask Tim to respond.
Well, that's certainly what the president was emphasizing and talking about. I think the phrase he used is 97% of scientists agree. Critics will argue, well, wait a minute, that number, that figure is a little bit misleading because you have a lot of scientists that weigh in that aren't climatologists and so forth. And one of the things I always find amusing is when the Barack Obama Twitter account tweets out claiming people are climate deniers. And the response is always, who's denying that we have climate? And the climate's always changing. But there's some difference in opinion as far as how serious the problem actually is just and whether we can do anything about it.
Just in our final seconds here, I want to change completely. We are in the global scene, so it's not too much of a... But the global tracking of Edward Snowden, who revealed some state secrets, and the effect on major power relations. He's traveled from Hong Kong. Now apparently he's in Moscow. Is custody of Snowden a bargaining chip internationally?
You know, I'm not sure that it is so much. The problem is that if he has some secrets that he probably – countries that are interested in them may have already gotten them. You know, I don't know what he's carrying. He's got laptops. If they've been out of his possession, if people have had them, it's certainly an embarrassment to the administration, particularly the way Russia has reacted and China and so forth. But we just kind of have to wait and see how this plays out, both in terms of Snowden specifically and the secrets that may or may not exist.
Thank you, Tim. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Statton. Our executive producer, Catherine Perkins. And we had production assistance today from Julie Englander and Tony Daner. I'm Dean Borg. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.